Lecture 20, Conrad, Heart of Darkness.
Conrad's Heart of Darkness reminds us that a literary classic is probably like the proverbial cat with nine lives, except that nine might be an understatement. People have said that we reinvent Shakespeare every generation. Shakespeare is Shakespeare, but that he continues to live in different clothes and different guises, telling a different story, it seems. So what is Heart of Darkness? It's the book, it's really a pivotal book for this course, because with it, you'll see that certain sorts of things become problematic. The most important one is telling a story becomes problematic. Is this an adventure yarn? It certainly can be read that way. I think it was read that way when it was first written. Or is it an anatomy of imperialist Europe, which is how many people today would read it? A critique of colonialism, which is like a sibling version of the critique of imperialism? Or is it saturated with the kind of racist, phobic view of blacks and Africans? What about the writing? Is the writing gorgeous, or is it purple, or is it just impressionistic? Is it a picture of the end of the 19th century, which many people think, or is it in fact a prophetic picture of the 20th, or if we're going to say prophetic, a prophetic picture of the 21st? Is it a study of the demonic? Is it an allegory about writing? It was published at the end of the 19th century, and it has been read as an end-stage document for 19th century Europe because of both its subjectivity and its indeterminacy. If you think about the other books we've looked at in this course, they're pretty chunky affairs, and some of them almost require two hands to carry, like War and Peace, or Bleak House, Brothers Karamazov. Here is a very slim volume, scarcely a novel, not beefy at all, and yet it depicts a crisis in storytelling. We know what the story is. It's the story of Marlowe's account of his voyage up the Congo into the Dark Continent in search of the mysterious Kurtz. We know that this is based largely on several different models. One of them is Conrad's own experience piloting a boat up the Congo when he was still quite young, but also the very famous pursuit of Livingston by Stanley in Africa, other adventure stories that were well known. So if you want to think of it as an adventure story, it has a lot of the earmarks of it, and yet it seems all the time to be gesturing towards riddle and unspeakability. And with that, because these could sound just like questions that professors are interested in, questions that writers are interested in, like crisis of storytelling. What does that really mean? We think of a crisis as when your heart stops beating or something. A crisis of storytelling is when a writer stops believing that his language works for him the same way. This is the modern condition for modern literature. That's why this is a pivotal text. It's a gateway text in more ways than one. So think about how confident the writers before us have been. Defoe never had any questions about whether the language he used for Moll Flanders' story was going to be a sufficient bridge for you to walk across it into the London of the 18th century and the adventures of this young woman. Or Dostoevsky's plumbing of the human soul with all of his different lingual forms, because Dostoevsky's book has poems and has tracts and it cites other texts, and yet its own language is supremely self-confident as well as self-aware. In this novelette, we begin to get the sense that the bridge is collapsing, that the umbilical cord, and it's scarcely a metaphor that I'm using, the umbilical cord between a piece of literature and a reader who reads it, because that's how these things live. Dead letters come to life because we invest them with our lives, and the past that is encapsulated in these dead letters comes to us via that cord. You'll see when I get to the conclusion of this course, I'm going to talk about that cord again. That cord's in trouble here. So there's a whole host of things that are sort of at a critical stage that we're going to look at for Heart of Darkness. It opens with the fascinating suggestion that London was once like Africa. You may remember the setting that Marlowe, the very genial narrator of this story, is sitting with his friends on the boat, the Nelly, outside of London on the Thames, and he's telling them about his adventures in the Congo. And he's telling them about the particular trip that's going to be, the voyage that's going to be narrated in this story. And he surprises them by saying that London was once Africa. And what he means is that in the eyes of the Romans, 2,000 years ago, when they first saw this outpost, for them it has to have been as primitive as we today might think of Africa. We today being Conrad at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. So it's a double voyage. It is to take us back into Africa, into the remote past, because Africa is going to represent the deep past, pre-civilization, and it is a voyage also textually, that we are to listen and follow and be fellow travelers with Marlowe as he weaves this tale in the dark, more or less. They're all sitting there on this boat with his listeners. Well, it's a grim tale. It's a portrait, among other things, as I've already suggested, of European exploitation. Ruthless, inhuman, hypocritical, in particular in the search of ivory that reduces the African workers to the status of cannon fodder, slaves. That's what the Belgian financial interests are interested in, production of ivory, finding of ivory. And we see how much bestiality and horror can go into this. And Conrad wants us to think about both of these things. On the one hand, this trip back into the past, I quote, "Going up that river was like traveling back to the earliest beginnings of the world." You go back into the beginnings prior to culture. And he says it meant taking on an inheritance, an accursed inheritance. It's an encounter as you go up the Congo with prehistoric man. And this will be one way of troping or typing or typologizing the actual Africans who were seen on the sides of the river and some on the boat. And he said that this trip brings you into contact with your own earliest origins. This is Europe looking into the mirror, looking into the glass, thinking about where it has come from. The thought of your remote kinship with this wild and passionate uproar. And he's talked about seeing these gesticulating native figures on the shores, yelling and whirling of black limbs, etc., masses of hands clapping. And you get a sense of the sort of savage African doing his performance there and representing for Marlowe the origins of human beings, almost Darwinian picture of where the race comes from. In some ways, this could be thought of as the hideous African, the African who was almost a specimen in a museum. But the other trip that I'm saying is that it's a trip also into understanding what kind of ruthless exploitation, what kind of ideological and economic system is in play here. This is why this text, unlike anything we've read up to now, is a severe critique of Europe. It's a severe critique of Western culture. Today, that notion is such a, particularly at the university, every other literature course is a critique of Western culture, that Conrad seems to me to be inaugurating this, even though he is not going to be flamboyant about it, and he's going to be the target, as I'm going to mention later, of a good bit of it. Well, I want to quote a few passages that make it clear that Conrad knows how ugly the exploitation of the blacks in order to get the ivory is. This is how he describes them. "Six black men advanced in a file, toiling up the path. They walked erect and slow, balancing small baskets full of earth on their heads, and the clink kept time with their footsteps. Black rags were wound round their loins, and the short ends behind waggled to and fro like tails. I could see every rib. The joints of their limbs were like knots in a rope. Each had an iron collar on his neck, and all were connected together with a chain whose bites swung between them, rhythmically clinking. There's not much fanfare here. There's no rhetorical explosion of outrage. But I don't think any reader in good faith can fail to see that this is a picture of slaves, picture of people being severely, horribly mistreated. And if you don't get it then, Conrad tells you a few pages later, but the actual purpose of these Belgian interests, these financial interests that are going for the ivory was, to tear treasure out of the bowels of the land was their desire. That's pretty straightforward. With no more moral purpose at the back of it than there is in burglars breaking into a safe. I want you to remember those lines because Conrad is no dewy-eyed romantic. Conrad is aware of the kind of exploitation, systematic exploitation that's going on here, and it's certainly scarcely limited to the Belgian interests in the Congo. Well, the center of the story, the absent center of the story in some sense, the black hole of the story, is not so much Marlowe, who is its narrator, but Kurtz, whom Marlowe is seeking. That's why he's captaining this boat to go up the Congo to find this man who was a trader. Trader, T-R-A-D-E-R, ivory trader. And it turns out, makes it sound like you easily know these things. In fact, the whole story is about how difficult it is to really get your head around Kurtz. He is a great mystery. Turns out he's had a rather strange kind of life, that he started out as a great idealist. He even was the author of a study about trying to improve the treatment of the Africans. And yet, he seems to have been transmogrified. He seems to have changed. He's become a kind of monstrous figure himself. I'll read you some of Conrad's language for this because it's quite wonderful the way it's done. All Europe contributed to the making of Kurtz, we're told. We know that his mother was half English and his father was half French, so he's a kind of European specimen, and he's writing for the International Society of the Suppression of Savage Customs. But something seemed to have gone wrong. Conrad writes, Marlowe says, this must have been before his, let us say, nerves went wrong and caused him to preside at certain midnight dances ending with unspeakable rites. And we learn that this elegant, very rhetorical, eloquent report that he wrote, some 17 or 18 pages long, has a postscript that was scribbled later. And the report, of course, is this high-sounding, mellifluous document about improving the treatment of the black workers. What is scribbled at the bottom of this is, exterminate all the brutes. So perhaps Kurtz came to a change of mind. And that's what the book is going to be about. What exactly happened? Mr. Kurtz, I quote, lacked restraint in the gratification of his various lusts, that there was something wanting in him, some small matter which, when the pressing need arose, could not be found under his magnificent eloquence. And notice the way Conrad is going to take that word found and replay it. But the wilderness had found him out early. It's an interesting line. The wilderness had found him out early. You take a person, any one of us, and you put us in the wrong setting, and we lose our agency. We become acted upon. It's as if the relationship between individual and setting gets reversed, and the setting becomes authorized and empowered, and the person becomes an openable thing. The setting had found him out early and had taken on him a terrible vengeance for the fantastic invasion. I think it had whispered to him things about himself which he did not know, things of which he had no conception, till he took counsel with this great solitude. So here you see the title, The Heart of Darkness. The trip up the Congo into the dark continent is also an exploratory trip, not just into the remote past, prehistoric man, that folkloric model, as it were, as if today's Africans were prehistoric man, but it is also a trip into the darker recesses of the human heart. In this light, he's continuing the kind of exploration that we saw in the Brothers Karamazov, but it's also literalized. It's on a boat going up a river into Africa. And as I said, it's filled with a sense of ignorance, that you don't know who you are until you are under stress. You don't know who you are until you are placed in situations that find you out. I really like that language, find you out. They make you visible, readable. You can't do it yourself. It happens because you're in a situation that is scrutinizing you. Self-scrutiny is not going to get the job done. This is the existential Conrad that you don't know until you've been tested. And so the story is going to be a number of things. It's about Europeans in Africa. It's also about the corruptibility of the soul. And it's about perhaps the savagery, potential savagery, hidden in all civilized people. It's not an accident that Kurtz, who, as I said, is mysterious, enigmatic, this is a quest narrative. They're all trying to reach him. And it's not an accident that he is imaged for us as a voice. The man presented himself as a voice, Marlowe says. He presented himself as a voice. It's an interesting notion that we present ourselves to others as language. We think that we present ourselves as images. People who know me know what I look like. Of course, if anybody's listening to this tape, they have no idea what I look like. But that one generally perceives oneself in a kind of ocular fashion and not in an aural fashion. And yet, of course, literature would be exactly the discourse, the field of expression, which regards the world as voice, as language. Homer, for us, is a voice, and so is Shakespeare. And therefore, they are just as unreachable, unvisualizable, enigmatic as Kurtz is. In this case, it's an eloquent voice. His words, the gift of expression, illuminating, these are the terms that Marlowe uses for him. Heart of Darkness reads to some extent like a treasure hunt, a narrative treasure hunt, as we approach ever more closely this enigmatic man at the end of the trail, Kurtz. And we get clues that bring us closer and closer. But we are also told that imagining Kurtz is tricky. It's not so simple to figure out who he was, and it's not risk-free either. They're trying to figure out who Kurtz is, and they said it's hard to understand him. You knew that he had gone wrong. I quote, "The thing was to know what he belonged to, how many powers of darkness claimed him for their own." And Conrad says that was, or Marlowe, the reflection that made you creepy. And the reason that it makes you creepy, that it's not good to imagine things like that. And I like that line. It's not good to imagine darkness. What it tells us is that imagination itself is the journey. Imagination itself is the slippage of gears. It's the loosening of anchor. It's the becoming available, porous, invadable, taking on others and bringing them into ourselves. Well, Marlowe says that to imagine this man was not good for you because you who are seated, standing, are trying to imagine a man who has lost his grounding, lost the floor under him. That's what it means to go back into this remote darkness. How could you, Marlowe says, with solid pavement under your feet, how could you imagine Kurtz? How can you imagine what particular region of the first ages a man's untrammeled feet may take him into by way of solitude, utter solitude without a policeman? And he's going to repeat that word policeman several times. What would it be like if there were no police? Again, close to Dostoevsky, what happens if everything is permitted? What might we discover that we don't particularly want to discover about ourselves? Well, that's what, of course, Kurtz is emblematic of. That's what happened to Kurtz in the Heart of Darkness. He discovered his own. The hyper-articulate Marlowe is trying to describe for his friends on the boat, the Nelly, what exactly happened. And he constantly sort of interrupts himself by saying, but you're not getting it. I'm not conveying it. Remember my image, umbilical cord? I can't get him to you. He says, he was just a word for me. I did not see the man in the name any more than you do. Do you see him? Do you see the story? This is the crisis in confidence that sets in with this book. Do you see the story? Do you see anything? It seems to me I'm trying to tell you a dream. Do you see anything? I'm tempted almost to stop and just lecture about that phrase, do you see anything? How many books have you read where you don't see anything, where it's just dead letters, where there may be some amount of information, but there is nothing imaginative that comes through to us, where that umbilical cord, in a sense, stops functioning, stops conveying the actual life on the far side of it, the life that is somehow encrypted in those words into us so that they become living. Conrad is gesturing here towards the greatest problem that all writers ever face. How do you make your story, your material, alive to readers? And I make it sound like a writer's problem. It's not a writer's problem. It's a verbal problem. How do we make ourselves alive to the people that we talk to? As a teacher, I talk to my students all the time, and I wonder, are my words living for them? I mean, they're taking notes, but does it ever really actually live? Do the books that they read, that I ask them to read, that I make them read, do they live? It's a question that any parent who's ever talked to a child and seen that blank, vacant expression in a child's face has to have asked him or herself. Is this getting across? Does this umbilical cord work? So there's a lot at stake in the kind of crisis or collapse that Conrad is interested in. And it goes beyond, I think, ideology. And it goes beyond the kinds of things that the political critics today are interested in. People have also said, whose story is this, by the way? Is this Marlowe's story? He's sitting on the Nellie telling all his friends about it. Or is it really the story of Kurtz? And that's a question that you couldn't have asked earlier. For most literature, you know whose story it is. It's true, Ishmael tells the story of Ahab, but you never wonder. You realize it's about Moby Dick, it's about the Pequot, it's about Ahab. With this story, you can't tell. In Wuthering Heights, when I lectured on it, I said there's a seer-scribe model that we've got Nellie Dean and we've got Lockwood trying to tell the story of Catherine and Heathcliff, who are almost unreachable themselves. And I think that's the case here with Kurtz. Kurtz is almost unspeakable. There are many other novels that I'm not lecturing on in this course, like The Great Gatsby. It takes Nick Carraway to tell Gatsby's story. Gatsby couldn't tell it. I call this a seer-scribe model. And so Marlowe is the scribe for the seer, Kurtz, and it means that the straightforward ways of telling a story have sort of gone out of business. And therefore, it's not surprising that this story has generated tons of different, really incompatible interpretations. Some recently have seen it as deconstruction. Deconstruction meaning that it's sort of undecidable, that it's only about language, it's about words, and that's exactly what Marlowe said. He was just a word for me. That you never get past words. And certainly the semantic critics from Saussure on have told us that words themselves never get to meaning. You look at a dictionary and you want to know what a word means. It doesn't tell you what it means. It tells you another word. That you're always locked within a word system. They call that sign and referent. But we know that the word L-O-V-E can't be the same thing as what we want that word to signify. So they say that this text is an early example of that kind of problem. Others have said, psychologically speaking, this is a kind of rites of passage story. The quest for Kurtz is also a kind of account of one's own voyage into one's own dark heart, thinking of Joseph Campbell and some of the myth investigations that he took on. Or philosophically, it's been argued that it's a kind of nihilist story, that everything is sort of unraveling into nothing. That's what people said about this story and still say about it, but one of the most important observations about this story was made in 1975 by the Nigerian writer Chinua Achebe, who said that this story, which he said is taught all over the English-speaking world as a classic, anthologized in textbooks, and that this story, I quote him, was bloody racist. And it's odd, isn't it? It took until 1975 for somebody to say this story is racist. I said we reinvent Shakespeare, and that means that we see things in Shakespeare that nobody saw then. We're worried about the anti-Semitism in The Merchant of Venice. Shakespeare wasn't worried about it. We see issues of race in Othello that Shakespeare wasn't worried about. Or at least he didn't see them the same way, couldn't have, that we do. And so in this story, the backdrop of the prehistoric man, those savages on the sides of the river, Achebe says, they're not recognized as human beings. They're simply used as a kind of backdrop to tell a white story about Marlowe and Kurtz. They're simply there, you know, as implements. They have no dignity at all, no dimensionality as people. And why are they cast as kind of black, prehistoric savages? They have a culture of their own. You'd never know it from this story. Marlowe doesn't talk about it. There's no anthropological perspective in the story at all. No sense that they'd have their own integrity. They seem to be a different species, used almost as metaphors to connote the wildness, fierceness, ferocity lurking at the core of the human being. And the only way that Conrad knew how to say it was to make them black Africans. Ever since Achebe wrote this piece, the post-colonial scholars have sort of seen it as a kind of absolutely crucial perspective on Conrad. They have acknowledged what I started by pushing when I first started the lecture, that Conrad is not soft on imperialism. He knows that the Belgian interests are cruel and inhuman, and yet that doesn't stop him from troping or typologizing the Africans as less than human. It hardly needs to be said that we are not clear of these issues today. Othering, as they say in the university, other people, not granting them quite fully human status. Think how this stamps human history. Think how long women have suffered under that particular onus. Think how long people of color, think how long people from different ethnic and religious groups. It is the history of the world to deny full humanity to those who are not like us. And so this book has been often inscribed in that reading. But it is also, I think, a story about power. In this case, it's about getting the ivory out of Africa to make the Belgian financial interests wealthy. It's the exploitation along economic lines. But we can think of power in other ways, and it is not at all surprising, and it's quite appropriate, that the most provocative sort of remake of Heart of Darkness is Coppola's film Apocalypse Now. I think with a fabulous sense of tact, Coppola understood that the American adventure or misadventure in Vietnam was an appropriate continuation of Conrad's story. Of the European project, in this case the American project, either at sea, lost, over its head, not able to read the signs. But you don't have to stop at Vietnam. It seems to me that we are never through discovering our own collusion with violence and evil, particularly when issues of race come into the mix, or ethnicity, so that the behavior at Abu Ghraib prison, or what's going on in Darfur, or the instances of this kind of exploitation of others, whether it's genocidal, whether it's just prejudice, this goes on throughout the globe today. It will be tomorrow. And I think Conrad is really required reading for this. Further, he's asking, and that's why Abu Ghraib is an interesting reference point, he's asking, do you know how you will hold up? Do you know if you can be accountable? Do you know what happens when you are subjected to sufficient stress? Do you know that you can hold on to standards? At its most frightening, this story tells us that we can be bereft of standards, we can come apart. And so it is that we learn that Kurtz had kicked himself over the edge and kicked himself loose from the universe. I didn't know whether I stood on the ground or floated in the air. It's as if he has lost his grounding, and so too does Marlowe feel it. And you realize that's what this story's been about, these people on a boat going up a river. They don't have any ground to stand on. We wouldn't be able to tell where we were going to, whether upstream or downstream, etc. That's what it means to lose one's orientation. This is the fissuring and coming undone of the human being. It's more than just evil. It's losing all sense of directionality, both moral and also physical. And therefore, the story closes with an emphasis, not just closes, but throughout, on Conrad's seaman's code, a work ethic. You simply keep your eyes to the job that is done because it's the only way you can hold on to who you are. Thank you.